Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
Hello and welcome to Living Planet. I'm Charlotte Lomas in Bonn. This week, extreme weather threatens the future of coffee in Brazil. Locals try to tackle Morocco's waste problems. And how to buy your groceries without all that plastic packaging. All this and more here on Living Planet. But first, a study released this week by the National Bureau of Economic Research suggests there's a strong link between climate change and conflict. The working paper reviewed 55 separate studies, concluding a clear correlation existed between increased violence and changes in weather and temperature. Earlier I spoke to the study's co-author, Stanford researcher Marshall Burke, to find out more, and started off by asking him why climate change produces more violence.
There are many different explanations for why climate could affect conflict coming out of these different studies. The main explanation from our field, from economics, has to do with what happens in a really bad year, so in a drought year or in a really hot year. So what we know about the economics of that is in a bad year, we know that agricultural productivity in particular declines. Another explanation comes from psychology, and psychologists have studied for a long time the relationship between hotter temperatures and human aggression. And what they find over and over is, as humans are just really bad physiologically at dealing with hot temperatures, when it's hot out, we become more aggressive, we become worse at making decisions. And they've shown in the lab, and now we think we've shown in sort of broader scale data, that this actually leads to substantially more violence.
So what types of conflicts or violence did the study look at, and what climate factors were considered?
So we cast a very wide net in terms of the types of conflicts we looked at. We looked at everything from what we call interpersonal conflict. This is things like aggravated assault and murder, up to large group level conflicts. This is things like riots and civil wars. On the climate side, we again cast a pretty wide net. We looked at a broad range of climate variables, but most of the focus was on changes in precipitation and changes in temperature.
So just to clarify, is it that climate change increases the likelihood or the odds of violence from happening?
That's exactly what we find. So looking back through time and looking, you know, at various settings around the world, what we find is a consistent relationship, in particular between hotter than average temperatures and increases in the likelihood of conflict. So in 24 out of the 24 studies that we were able to analyze that looked at the relationship between temperature and some conflict outcome, all 24 showed a positive relationship between temperature and violence.
So what were the main findings of your research?
The main findings of our research, there's a strong relationship between increases in temperature and various types of conflict, everything from personal level conflict, things like aggravated assault and murders, all the way up to group-level conflicts, things like riots and civil wars. And in particular, we found in the tropics, a 1 degree Celsius increase in temperature is associated with a more than 20% increase in these large-scale civil conflicts.
What parts of the world did the study focus on?
So we were able to find studies looking at the relationship between climate and conflict from around the world. So again, studies from North America. So we had multiple studies looking at crime statistics from the U.S. We had studies in Latin America, for instance, a study looking at land invasions in Brazil. Many different studies from sub-Saharan Africa. That's where sort of the lion's share of our studies came from. But also studies from Europe and Asia as well, and also from Australia. So actually we had studies from every single continent in the world.
So could you give us some examples of countries with climate-induced conflicts?
Sure. So we actually see these results showing up all over the world. So you see it in crime statistics in the U.S., and you talk to police chiefs, and they've actually known this for a long time, right? They've noticed that crime actually spikes on really hot days. So what we're able to do in this study and what others have done, the studies that we've reviewed, is to show this very explicitly using, you know, lots and lots of data on different cities in the U.S. and different types of crime. So it shows up in the U.S., more crime on hot days, and it also shows up in these broader scale conflicts around the world, but particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, where we've seen a lot of civil conflicts over the last 2 to 3 decades. And again, what we see there is that the likelihood of these conflicts is much higher in hot years.
So how did the study measure this?
So the way these studies work is you collect data on a type of conflict. So say we're looking at civil wars in Africa, and you have to come up with some definition of what a civil war is. And so the typical definition is based on how many people died in the conflict. So So you get data on whether these civil wars have happened and when, and then you link that up with different data sources on temperature and precipitation. So in these studies, there are different ways to do it. But one thing you don't want to do is you don't want to compare two very different types of countries. So imagine Norway and Nigeria, right? We know that Norway is pretty cold, and we know that Norway doesn't have that much conflict, right? And now let's look at Nigeria. Nigeria is pretty hot, and it's had a fair amount of conflict in recent years. So the naive comparison would just be to compare Norway to Nigeria and say, look, this difference in conflict is correlated with this difference in temperature. But clearly that's a bad comparison because Norway and Nigeria differ along very many other dimensions aside from just the difference in temperature, right? So instead what we do is we compare Norway to itself or we compare Nigeria to itself. So we take Nigeria in a normal temperature year and we measure the conflict in that year, and then we compare that to Nigeria in a very hot year and we measure the amount of conflict in that year. So you can think about it as trying to approximate a randomized control trial where Nigeria is now sort of the control for itself.
And so was there a particular country that stood out as especially affected by climate change through conflict?
No particular country stood out. Again, what we were surprised by was the remarkable consistency in this relationship across different settings. Again, the types of conflict differ, so we do not see civil conflict in the U.S. We don't see civil wars in the U.S., for instance, or in Western Europe, you know, over the last few decades. So we're not claiming there's a relationship between temperature and civil war in Europe or the U.S. Instead, what we see there is this relationship with crime, so a type of conflict that we do see a lot of, unfortunately. And what we see there, again, is that higher temperatures are associated with more of this type of conflict.
What added stresses does climate change place on societies?
So climate change looks like will place a lot of different stresses on societies, and it'll depend a little bit on what sort of society you're in. But if you're in a society that's dependent on agriculture, largely dependent on agriculture for your income, we know increases in temperature are going to hurt agricultural productivity. So this will be one of the most direct stresses of climate change. If you're in a place like the U.S., most people aren't farmers, but what research has shown and what psychologists have looked at for a long time is it doesn't matter if you're farming or not. People are just sort of more unhappy, and they get along less well with each other on a really hot day. So there will also be this sort of direct effect of heat stress on human physiology.
Marshall Burke there talking about climate change and conflict. Coffee is one of the most popular drinks in the world, so much that it's the world's second largest commodity. But that commodity is now under severe pressure. Extreme weather has destroyed a large part of this year's harvest in Brazil, the world's largest exporter of coffee. Drought has triggered a coffee crisis damaging the economy of thousands of small coffee farmers and is causing coffee prices to rise globally. Asker Mao and Stefan Stubager have this report from Brazil.
Let's see where they are.
Under the dry Brazilian sun, João Stout is surveying coffee fields for damage.
This field was just harvested. We still have some left beans in here. And you can see here the effects of the drought.
Many of the coffee beans from this year's crop are destroyed.
And some of them has nothing inside. You see here? They are completely empty, pure husks.
And the writing is on the walls for next year's crop, with trees looking like wooden skeletons with thin branches devoid of leaves.
Very, very few producing branches are left, and most of the tree is not recovering from the drought.
Stout is the director of Qualicafix, a company that helps farmers sell their coffee overseas. But sales will be down this year after southeastern Brazil was hit by one of the worst droughts in living memory.
It's completely dried up.
Nationally, the dry weather has destroyed around 9 million bags of coffee beans, or 16% of Brazil's total potential of around 54 million bags. And some, like João Stout, fear that next year's harvest will be even more meager.
It's a worrying feeling because we are not sure if we are going to be able to keep those fields in production with the difficulties the growers have now.
João Stout is concerned, but not surprised. We get in his car and drive around the hilly area of coffee fields that he knows all too well.
We are right crossing the border, São Paulo with Minas Gerais.
Stout's family has grown coffee since 1965, and for decades, Stout worked as a coffee farmer himself. But in the early 90s through to the beginning of the 21st century, Stout started to notice changing patterns in the weather. More droughts, warmer weather, and unusual rainfall.
More, let's say, difficult times in terms of weather.
So another factor was added to the normally risky business that is coffee.
Stout had to hire more people to plant and tend to coffee trees and pick the coffee cherries. Joao Stout thought coffee cultivation had become too expensive and too risky, and therefore he decided to break his family's long tradition and sell most of their coffee fields.
I feel that to produce coffee, it's a huge task that I'm very relieved to be away from production side. It's too tough, too risky. I don't have the guts anymore to do that.
Instead, Joao Stout created Qualicafix, an exportation company that avoids the risk of producing and makes money from selling the harvests of other coffee farmers. Many of those farmers are now facing challenges from the weather, the very challenges Stout himself wanted to escape from. Next to large fields of coffee trees in the hills of Minas Gerais state, 52-year-old Ivani Contino walks around her farm feeding her chickens. This year's drought has destroyed as much as 30% of her family's coffee harvest, their only source of income. The drought requires more staff to tend to the fields and pick the crop. It is costing the family a lot of money.
Considering the money we can now sell the coffee for, it's not a good business. The cost of growing coffee is high, and the drought drives this cost even higher.
But the drought is possibly just a warning of what challenges are to come for Contino's family and the rest of the coffee industry. In 2012, a study by London's Royal Botanic Gardens warned that 70% of the world's coffee supply may disappear by 2080 because of climate change. That brings us to Tiago Ferreira, a market analyst whose job and life revolves around coffee.
When I don't get my coffee, I tend to feel nervous. It's a feeling like I need something to feel normal again.
He takes a sip from his ever-present coffee cup.
And now I feel perfect. I could drink more.
Agora é perfeito. Poderia tomar vários outros.
But his coffee-induced good mood is quickly replaced by the concerns Ferreira has about climate change.
Acho que os problemas climáticos, eles geram medo.
I think that the issue of climate change sends a sense of fear to the heart of the entire coffee industry. It is a new situation, and it could potentially cause major problems for production and ultimately affect prices and scare off consumers.
E chegaria até o consumidor.
This year alone, coffee prices have grown considerably due to the drought in Brazil, a country which accounts for around 35% of the global production.
Coffee prices on the largest American stock exchange, Nasdaq, have increased around 45% since last year.
Several of the largest selling American coffee chains have already raised prices in the U.S. Coffee giant Starbucks has raised prices by 1% for a number of their drinks, while packaged products cost just around 8% more. The chain restaurant Dunkin' Donuts, which sells more cups of coffee than any other company in the United States, has also raised prices. And if the extreme weather continues through to the next season, trading prices are expected to rise even more. Outside a Starbucks in Rio de Janeiro, we meet designer Deanna Horenstein, who gets her fix of coffee from the coffee chain every day. Horenstein says an increase of about half a dollar wouldn't deter her from her daily coffee intake.
That's all right, but if they raise prices more than that, then I'll probably drink a little less.
But Horenstein says a future completely without coffee is unimaginable.
I can't completely change my habits. I have to drink coffee before I leave home. Maybe it's psychological, but I get a headache if I don't drink my coffee.
Pode até ser psicológico, mas se eu não tomar, eu fico com dor de cabeça.
Life without coffee is also unimaginable for Joao Stout. Most people need to believe in something. Joao Stout believes in coffee.
Yeah, I am a believer.
And the exporter has faith that production will adjust even if some coffee areas are ruined by future climate change.
I think in 2080 we'll have coffee in very unusual areas of Brazil.
I can't tell you right now where, but we may have other areas suitable to grow coffee. Because coffee is a kind of a flexible culture.
While Stout has faith in coffee, Contino family has placed their faith in God to get them through this dry patch.
As long as there is coffee growing in the fields, we will fight. If it's what God wants, we'll pull through, right?
Whether God is on their side or not, because of the extreme weather and expensive labor, the coffee family has been forced to sell much of their land to survive in recent years. They used to have 70 hectares of coffee fields. Now they're down to 27. And if the drought continues, the family may be forced to sell more of their land until they could ultimately run out of coffee altogether.
Espero que chove, que senão o ano que vem não tem café.
I really hope it starts to rain. Otherwise, we will not have any coffee. That would make things difficult, as we currently only sell coffee. We depend on the coffee. Without it, we have nothing.
Acabou. Tem nada. Patim, 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 patim. Vem!
Asghar Mal and Stefan Stuhlbarger with that report. Going grocery shopping or food shopping, it's difficult to get away without a heap of plastic bags or packaging. A plastic bag for your vegetables, a plastic bag for your fruit. Your bread comes in a plastic bag, and so do your crisps. And then you need another plastic bag to hold all these plastic bags together. Well, as we heard on Living Planet's special episode on plastics, this plastic packaging is causing a major pollution problem for the Earth and for our oceans, not to mention the energy and resources that go into plastic production. So is it possible to escape this scourge of packaging? Well, one of our colleagues here at Deutsche Welle embarked on an experiment to do just that. For 1 week, she and a few of her friends tried going shopping without acquiring any new plastic packaging. Miriam Klausner joins us in the studio now to share some of her difficulties and successes she encountered during the experiment. Miriam, welcome.
Hi, Charlotte.
So if you weren't using plastic bags, what did you use instead to do your shopping?
Well, I've brought along some containers. I've plastic Tupperware for cheese or meat or dips, then the good old sealable can for loose tea or coffee beans. You've got the screw top jar for noodles or rice. And most importantly, cloth bags. This one here, it's still new. It's for bread, and the others can be used for fruit or vegetables.
Right. So what was your first plastic shopping-free experience like?
We went to a local supermarket, and buying things like fruit and vegetables without plastic bags, this was just fine. We put it in our cloth bags and had no trouble with that. But when it came to other products, it was a bit trickier.
What do you mean? Why is that?
For example, deli products. I mean, we were prepared. We brought along our Tupperware containers to buy cheese. And the lady said she'd be happy to put the cheese in our Tupperware containers, but she wasn't allowed to.
Why is that?
Because of some hygiene codes. But then she said, OK, I'll do it, but just once and don't tell my boss. So we had to put our plastic containers on the deli counter. Then she weighed the cheese on a piece of paper and then dropped it from the paper into the container. Of course, this wasn't a complete success because that piece of paper went into the bin.
So surely, though, there would be things that don't require any packaging at all, like bread, right?
Yeah, bread was much easier. But even then, the baker said, I think it's a great idea, you've brought along your cloth bags, but I'm not allowed to take them behind the counter.
Why? Why is that?
Again, because of hygiene codes. Mm. And the baker found a way around that. We had to put our cloth bags on the counter, and then he'd fish the buns out with the tongs and then drop them into the bag without making contact with the bag.
All right. So from what you've told us so far, these hygiene codes seem to have been the biggest barrier to your plastic-free shopping experience. Was anyone able to clarify exactly what these hygiene codes are?
None of the supermarket workers. So I rang Germany's Consumer Affairs Agency and spoke to Isabel Mühleisen.
In Germany, we don't have specific hygiene codes. What applies here are EU-wide hygiene regulations. They're pretty simple. They say the goal is to sell defect-free wares. Exactly how that is supposed to be done is not specified.
Spezifische Vorschriften, wie das zu erreichen ist, das ist nicht vorgeschrieben.
But who decides what the person behind the counter can do and what they can't do?
That's what I asked her, and she said,
"Es kommt darauf an, wie der Marktleiter entscheidet."
It's the market leader who decides, so the boss. If this person says it's too risky to allow the customer's container onto the counter or behind the counter, then the customer has to accept that.
Dann muss das akzeptiert werden.
Right, so the supermarkets were a big challenge. Were there any places where it was no problem at all to purchase what you wanted without packaging?
Yes, mostly at smaller stores, like Asian grocers, where you can rice in bulk, or the organic food market for cheese, for example, or meat or fish. But what really surprised us were the big organic supermarket chains. There was no chance to get anything in our containers. The little stands at the organic food markets, they were fine. They're familiar with the codes, they're familiar with how to give us our stuff without breaking any law.
So far you've talked about groceries. What about toiletries like shampoos, soaps and toothpaste?
Huge problem. We also didn't want to mix our own shampoo, so the compromise was to buy large packages instead of many small ones. But yes, this is plastic.
Okay, so you bought some plastic in the end. So overall, did going without plastic packaging really restrict you terribly?
In a way, yes, because you really have to plan what you want to buy in advance because of all the containers you have to take along. It happened to us a few times that we couldn't buy any cheese, for example, because we didn't bring along our Tupperware. Or coffee to go. If you forgot our thermos cup, no coffee.
And the hardest part of the whole experience was?
Chips, chocolate bars, cookies. I mean, where do you buy those without packaging? So we didn't eat chips or chocolate. We baked our own cookies. But after a week, we decided that our experiment had also to be suitable for day-to-day living. And takeaway food like pizza, Thai curry, burgers, we took our plates or Tupperware to collect our ordered food.
So now you've documented this plastic-free shopping experience. What was the general response from the public like?
In the supermarket, people reacted really positively to what we were doing. And the funniest part was even the ladies working there were saying, "Hey, it's really crazy how much packaging we produce here every day, but we can't do anything about it. We have to do it." And the responses we got on our blog, it really blew us away. We thought, okay, maybe we'd get 300 clicks in a week. But after 1 week, we had about 10,000 clicks. And now we have about 41,000. So it seems to me that people are really interested in this issue. And, well, I guess it's something a lot of people can relate to. Everyone goes shopping. Everyone seems to be frustrated about the whole packaging which goes to the bin afterwards. And people want to know how they can shop with less packaging.
So some people have even written in with suggestions for you, I understand. Can you give us some examples?
Yes, like using olive oil soap to wash our hair or to use as liquid detergent or even to get a cow so we could have plastic-free milk.
So what's next with this project?
We extended the experiment from 1 week to 9 months, so until now. And our next goal is to publish a directory or some kind of shopping guide that lists all the shops where you can buy stuff without packaging.
Well, it sounds very exciting and we look forward to hearing more about it. Thanks for joining us in the studio today, Miriam.
Thanks, Charlotte.
Well, if you're up for the plastic-free supermarket challenge and also live in Germany, you could also just cheat and visit one of a handful of plastic-free supermarkets across Germany. From plastics to landfill, our next story takes us to Morocco, a country with a huge trash pollution problem. Here, more than 5 million tonnes of solid waste is generated across the country, most of which isn't separated, leading to all kinds of trash ending up in landfill. Most of these sites are illegal waste dumps where e-waste sits rotting next to industrial or medical waste. As a result, toxins seep into the soil and the sea, causing big environmental concerns. But one group of Moroccans has had enough. They came up with a small recycling project and are now trying to convince authorities and locals to do the same. Dunya Sadaki reports from Rabat and Sarah Steffen presents this report.
Saïd Kitan is proud of his laboratory here at the university in Rabat. He points to tables, which stand in the clinical white-tiled room, covered in computer parts and electronic gadgets. It's where students in white coats disassemble the devices. Just next door, machine separates raw materials from the rest of the trash. Kitan, who heads the laboratory, picks up different buckets.
Donc voilà, on récupère le cuivre. That's how we retrieve copper, iron. We can reuse all this plastic here. And then there's gold. Electronic waste contains about 120 to 140 grams per ton, so it's of some value.
And that's what this is all about. Trash is not just trash. It has value. Kitan and his team hope they can use this argument to convince people to start recycling. And they want Moroccan authorities and private companies to participate too. Project manager Safa Mohadem says they would benefit a great deal from a recycling scheme.
In Morocco, we have a research that says that in Morocco we have 1 million tons of electronic and electrical waste every year. So this huge amount of waste, if we can recycle it, it will give millions and millions and millions of euro.
But it's not just about the money. And it's not just about electronic waste. There's an overpowering stench on the streets here in Morocco, as many people simply burn their trash out of the open. Other kinds of waste end up in illegal dump sites, where waste from hospitals mixes with plastic bags and sewage sludge. This deeply concerns Mohadem.
Especially plastics or electric and electronic waste, they are destroying the environment. So many, many people in Morocco still have no real idea about the danger that this waste threatens. I think it's not only the responsibility of Moroccan people, but also the people who are responsible, like the government or the authorities, because we have to make special places for the waste to be thrown in, and especially to specify many categories. For example, in Europe, there is trash for plastic, a trash for metal or something like that. So we don't have it here in Morocco. That's why we are working in this project, actually to plant this culture.
Mohadem tries to reach out to young people to encourage them to recycle. She plans to hold workshops for women and socially disadvantaged people. She aims to show them how they can make money off their own small recycling units. Researcher Omar Ed Raouche, who helps finance the project, says a lot of people stand to profit from this project.
Il y a la crise du chômage. Il y a la stagnation de certains secteurs d'activité.
We're stuck in a crisis. Unemployment rates are high. Many industries are at a standstill. But recycling is something new. There's a huge potential. Morocco is ready. We consume a lot, such as TVs, cell phones, etc. And all that contains valuable raw materials, and those can be sold on the market. And if we create such recycling units, we can fight unemployment. We would include businesses, the social aspect, and protecting our environment.
On a le social et puis la protection de l'environnement.
Raouche won a prize from his university for the project, which awarded him about 8,000 euros. But it's simply not enough. And time is running out. Waste is poisoning Morocco's soil and water, warns Kitan.
On peut pas continuer et produire des déchets.
If we continue producing so much trash, not only will we encounter major health problems, but also problems in terms of environmental pollution. Seeping water dissolves heavy metals such as mercury, lead, chromium, cadmium, and that's toxic for the environment.
C'est le cadmium. Et tous ces métaux-là, ils sont très toxiques pour l'environnement.
Authorities in Morocco have now started to fight against the piles of trash as well. There's an open debate about environmental protection and how to deal with resources. However, they lack the funds and staff. And then there's also the issue of corruption, which makes it incredibly hard to enforce regulations.
That report there from Dunya Sadaki. Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of Living Planet. You can download episodes or replay them online at dw.de/environment. You can also find us on iTunes and SoundCloud. Tune in next week for more news and stories about the environment. Until then, from all of us here in the studio in Bonn, thanks for listening. Just like children sleep.